Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. I would now like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you so much, Candace, and I too would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Workshop, Medical Update on Acute Myelogenous Leukemia, or AML. And today's very important program, I know many of you have awaited hearing this program, and it's a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations, both cancer organizations in general and many blood cancer organizations. And it really is because of that collaboration and your interest in the program today that we've been able to reach so many of you on the call today. We have over 631 participants on the call on this program today, and you come from all over the United States, from all different regions and different locations in the United States, some of you in very urban areas, some in very rural and frontier areas, and some in suburban areas as well, so from really all different regions. And we also have international participants from Canada, Japan, India, United Kingdom, and Venezuela. So it's really a global call to some extent. Although the majority of you are in the U.S., we have people listening from other parts of the world as well. So we're delighted that you've all chosen to spend this next hour with us. And today's program is supported by AbbVie, Agios, the Celgene Corporation, Novartis Oncology, and Pfizer. And I really want to thank them for their support of our program today. And we have, and also for their collaborative cooperation in making this program possible. We have wonderful speakers today, and really the best of the best as far as we're concerned. And our first speaker is Dr. John Pagel. And Dr. Pagel is Chief of Hematologic Malignancies Program, Director, Stem Cell Transplantation, Swedish Cancer Institute in Seattle, Washington. And Dr. Pagel is going to address an overview of acute myelogenous leukemia, treatment options, and important questions to ask when communicating with your healthcare team. It's now my pleasure to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Pagel.
Thank you, Carolyn, and it's nice to be with everybody here on the phone today. I'm in Seattle, Washington. I always like to give everybody an update of what the weather's like in Seattle, and believe it or not, today it's idyllic. There's actually not a cloud in the sky. It does happen here occasionally, and I hope to be outside later today. We'll see how that goes. It's a pleasure to be with everybody to discuss a little bit of a background and an overview treatment options on acute myeloid leukemia, or AML. I will spend the next 10 or maybe 15 minutes giving a broad picture, perhaps, but I know Dr. Pearl, who's a true expert in this disease, will do an excellent job talking about some of the more interesting and new therapies that are coming on and the practical aspects about how to handle everyday issues with regard to getting treatment, perhaps, with AML. So, you know, just like a patient can get a cancer of any part of their body, you know, breast, colon, prostate, you can get a cancer of blood cells. Blood just happens to be an organ that's in a liquid form. And most of the time when we get a cancer in a blood cell, it happens in a white blood cell. And there are two major classes of types of cells that can become cancerous, or I should say types of white blood cells that can become cancerous. They're either what we call a myeloid cell or a lymphoid cell. There are two different types of cells that go on to make different other important immune system cells. And we're going to focus really on the myeloid cell line. So essentially what happens is that these cells are cells that are born in our bone marrow. They have a job to do normally. A normal myeloid cell is to grow up, perhaps leave the house, that's leaving the bone marrow, getting out in the circulation in the blood, and they grow and mature and become adults and even very mature, hardworking cells, and often those cells mature into cells we call neutrophils. And these types of cells, as they mature and become the most mature cells, are commonly important for fighting infections. Myeloid stem cells, or those precursor baby cells, can also not only grow up and become adult neutrophils, but they can become red blood cells and platelets as well. Platelets, of course, are the blood clotting cells that are very important for controlling bleeding. Most of the time, there is a normal maturation process of these cells. They grow, they leave the house, they do their job, fight an infection perhaps, and then those cells die. But of course, something can go wrong in one of these cells at any time. That's essentially what cancer is. It's just where a cell becomes abnormal and it behaves abnormally. And when it happens in a myeloid cell, in a very immature myeloid cell, perhaps before it's even become and differentiated into a neutrophil or another mature cell, that immature myeloid cell has something go wrong and it leads to a disease known as acute myeloid leukemia, AML. What does that mean? Well, the acute part means that it's something that comes on very quickly. People will usually get sick within a matter of weeks or so. The myeloid part I've just described, that has to do with the cell that it and its white blood cell and its maturation process that I've discussed. And the word leukemia essentially just means that this is circulating in the blood. That's the definition of leukemia, and that's where we're focusing here on acute myeloid leukemia. Many people will often ask, well, how does that happen and why does that happen? Unfortunately, most of the time we don't really know why it happens. We can't assign a true cause for the vast majority of patients. We know that over time, mistakes can happen in our normal cellular machinery. Something can go wrong, and normally we don't ever even know that because we have repair mechanisms to repair mistakes that might happen, but sometimes those mistakes aren't repaired. And a cell then becomes abnormal, it behaves abnormally, meaning it doesn't grow up to become the normal grandparent cells or the normal mature neutrophils, and they make more of themselves and circulate in the blood and cause other problems. So we don't always know why people will get acute leukemia. We know that there are some potential reasons. Certainly, we think that there might be some relationship to exposures, maybe even things like radiation or those types of things in some select cases. But in general, again, we know that this mistakes that can happen in our cellular machinery happen without a true known cause. One of the things that we do clearly understand and recognize is that there is a state that we might call a pre-leukemic state that can lead to AML, and it's something we call myelodysplasia, or MDS. And MDS is a abnormality of the blood cells where they're not completely normal, but they haven't evolved into acute leukemia. People might have MDS for many years, but the risk is that it also can lead to AML. So there's two major ways that people get AML. It's either from MDS or some primary treatment. Perhaps they got treated for a breast cancer or something like that and got chemotherapy before. We know that chemotherapy is certainly a risk for getting a leukemia down the road, as an example. Or they develop leukemia or AML, what we would call just spontaneously, or sometimes you might hear the words called de novo, meaning it didn't come out of a primary treatment from chemotherapy or it didn't come out of myelodysplasia. We know that people, when they present with AML, usually are fairly sick. Might be problems with fevers. They may feel significant fatigue. It's possible that they might be anemic because they're not making enough red blood cells. Sometimes people have, unfortunately, bleeding problems because their platelets are not behaving normally or they don't have enough platelets. And sometimes the white blood cell count, those leukemic cells, can be very high in the blood. And that's a common way that this disease comes on, and it requires attention usually very quickly. Most of the time, people will get treated with some therapies that will help them feel better very quickly. And it can be in a somewhat emergent setting in many cases. And in fact, if the white count is too high, it can be somewhat risky to leave it with a high white count for a long time. So sometimes we actually will pull white cells out of the blood through a procedure we call apheresis or apheresis. Not commonly done, but in extreme cases that might be the case. We also want to get on top of what's going on with the patients to make sure we control the bleeding, improve the need for red blood cells, and in many ways the treatment will help us achieve that. What are the standard treatments that we commonly use here? Well, we've been using standard treatments for AML that haven't dramatically changed for the last many decades. We typically use some therapy we call induction therapy or induction chemotherapy, which is usually a combination of different drugs. And there are a variety of what we call regimens that people can get in the upfront setting at the time of diagnosis that will typically control the disease and help put them into remission. You might hear the term 7+3 chemotherapy. It's a very standard regimen, the most widely used regimen in the United States for AML. It uses two different drugs. You might hear a drug class known as anthracyclines. Those might be something called daunorubicin or doxorubicin or idarubicin, and commonly with another drug called cytarabine. And those drugs are delivered over about a week, and typically they're done in the hospital for most patients. There are a variety of other regimens that are used, and I won't go into the long laundry list of what can be employed here, but it depends on the specific situation and the specific individual patient about what's right for them. And in fact, perhaps patients who are a bit older, and this is primarily a disease that happens more commonly in older people, they may not be able to do well with that standard induction treatment, so they may get a different, perhaps more gentler type of treatment. And I'm sure Dr. Pearl will say a word or two about those types of agents. But they may be something known as hypomethylating agents. There are drugs such as decitabine that might be employed, or lower doses of the standard drugs that also can be highly successful at putting people into remission. And sometimes people may need the regimen more than one time, but the goal is to get the disease to go away so that we can't find it, so that we can't find it in the blood or in the bone marrow. And we want to make sure that it's not showing up in other areas that's concerning as well, and sometimes that might be in the spinal fluid or in the central nervous system. So we look for all those spots. We treat patients very aggressively if we can, and the goal is to get them into a remission. Most patients will be able to achieve that. The challenge typically is keeping people in a remission. And again, it's different for each individual patient, but many times we will consider giving people more therapy after they've achieved a remission with the goal that we can keep their disease from coming back. So sometimes we do something called consolidation treatment, where we try and give ongoing routine infusions of some chemotherapy with the hope that we can continue to kill any remaining leukemia cells and provide a benefit for long-term survival. Also, sometimes we take people to what's known as a stem cell transplant. You've probably heard about stem cell transplantation before. I probably won't say much about that here, but to say that the type of transplants we do for AML are for patients who have responded to upfront treatment, who have high-risk disease, and they use stem cells from a donor, not from the patient. So transplant's a whole other kettle of fish, so to speak, but that's a way that we consolidate patients once they've achieved a remission in the appropriate patient with the goal to cure them, to get their leukemia to go away, and to keep it from ever coming back. Well, how do you figure out who gets what type of treatment? Well, there's a lot of factors that come into play there, and this is where you need to perhaps be very educated and talk to your doctor about what's right for you. We look at the patient's age and their fitness. Certainly younger people or people who are more fit, we're going to treat more aggressively. They would also perhaps be people that we'll consider for a transplant. And we also look at what we call the risk factors, and there are a variety of them. And we separate patients into usually low or intermediate or high risk. Low risk patients typically can be cured with standard chemotherapy and perhaps that consolidation chemotherapy alone without a transplant. Those are often patients who have characteristic genetic features that we know are more favorable. At the other end of the spectrum might be those patients who I alluded to early on who had gotten perhaps primarily chemotherapy before for, let's say, breast cancer, or those people who have evolved to AML from MDS. And those higher risk patients are the ones that we definitely try to treat more aggressively, maybe do a stem cell transplant with the hope that we can cure them in that way. The goals are different for each individual patient. We could talk a lot about that in and of itself on the call today, but that's where it comes into a mutual decision-making process with your physician. So it's important to understand your disease and to ask questions. Ask what the risk factors are that you might have for further treatment. Ask what the doctor thinks is the right treatment for you or your family member based on their fitness and what they can tolerate. And I always tell patients that the best advocate for you is you yourself. The patient's the best advocate, and you have to ask questions. And if you're not getting your questions answered, find another way to get them answered. Certainly, it's reasonable to get second opinions. We all accept that and know that that's appropriate and reasonable many times. I'd encourage you to go to reputable websites, such as Leukemia Lymphoma Society, as an example, or the American Cancer Society, and learn more about AML. It's a disease that has a lot of what we would say heterogeneity, meaning it's not the same in every individual patient. We have to accept that some patients might get treated one way and others might get treated another, and there's no right or wrong answer in many cases. So I only say that to say stay away, if you can, from information that might be anecdotal on the internet or blog rooms or chat rooms that might not be particularly relevant to you and your disease. Well, I've talked for about 15 minutes. It's gone fast. I hope I gave a reasonable overview and discussed in general the treatment options. I know Dr. Pearl will do a lot more of that, and I will just close by saying we've done a lot better in improving survival with acute myeloid leukemia for a variety of reasons. Dr. Pearl is going to talk a lot about management of a patient, and that's very, very important. And I hope that this was helpful to everyone, and it's been a pleasure to be on the call. Thank you, Carolyn, and I'll let you turn it over to Dr. Pearl.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Tegel. That was outstanding and a wonderful presentation, really presenting on the treatment options for AML and really helping people understand more about AML. So thank you. And our next presenter is Dr. Alexander Pearl. Dr. Pearl is Assistant Professor of Medicine, Division of Hematology Oncology, Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. And Dr. Pearl is going to address new therapies and clinical trial updates, symptom and pain management tips, and quality of life concerns. It's really my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Pearl.
Well, the pleasure is mine, Carolyn. Thank you so much for inviting me to come talk today. And thanks to Dr. Pagel also for that excellent introduction. I will start by just commenting on some of the points that Dr. Pagel had made previously, which is at present there are good therapies for AML, and while we're trying to establish new treatment approaches, those rest on the laurels of many years of developing these treatments. And while he said that some things have not changed in a long time, actually the winds of change are starting to blow in AML. So there are some major developments that have happened in the last few years and that are happening now, and it's a really exciting time in the field for people who are studying the disease biology. And I think for patients, it's always, you know, a hard diagnosis to be diagnosed with AML, but there is no time like the present in terms of having new opportunities for treatment, because many of them are just being thrust upon us and many of them are really opening new doors. Why are treatments needed for AML? We want to improve cure rates in this disease. We are not curing everyone with AML, and because that's the case, we want to improve what we can do. And on top of that, many of the therapies have significant side effects. And so even if we have therapies that are highly likely to cure patients, we want to see what we can do to decrease symptom burden and treatment toxicity. And those are the major reasons that we do clinical trials. I want to highlight a few areas that have been hugely successful in AML, and some of this has had to do with a better understanding of AML biology. And while Dr. Pagel mentioned some of the generalities about, you know, what are the blood cells doing in the bone marrow and how do they grow up, learn a trade, go out into the bloodstream and kind of work at their, become productive members of society as white blood cells to fight infections, red blood cells to carry oxygen and provide energy, and platelets to clot the blood. To get from a stem cell, which is a cell that can make any of these types of blood cells, to a mature cell requires a huge amount of work, and all of that work requires properly functioning genes. Our genes are the units of our DNA that create proteins that have functions in cells. And mutations can occur in these genes that change those proteins and ultimately change those functions, for better or for worse. They can increase the speed at which a cell grows or decrease the speed at which a cell grows, increase the speed with which it matures or decrease its likeliness to mature. And that can affect whether a cell is healthy or diseased. And it's these types of mutations that can contribute to the development of leukemia. And important to recognize that these mutations in general are not inherited. They happen after birth in cells that can live a very long time in our bodies. And these cells can pick up mutations, and once the mutations are present, they affect any cell that arises from the prior cell. So if those mutations occur in the stem cells that live our entire lives, they can lead to long-lived blood cells that are dysfunctional. And that's why we think some patients will develop a condition like myelodysplastic syndrome, or MDS, or develop AML. And it's not one mutation that leads to this disease. Usually it's several. And for many years, we had very little guidance as to what the different mutations were in AML, other than looking globally at the chromosomes, which is the packages of DNA. And the DNA actually can be packaged into, you know, several different chromosomes, of which we get 23 from mom and 23 from dad, so 23 pairs of chromosomes. And all of the genes for all of the proteins we need our cells to use are encoded in there, sort of like a big recipe book that you would use to run a whole kitchen. And that tells the cell how to make any recipe and basically how to do any function. So you can imagine if you acquired several different mutations that could contribute to the development of this disease. And some of these mutations we can see by large-scale changes in those chromosomes that are actually visible under the microscope. And the field that studies this is called cytogenetics. So it's been known for a long time that AML cells can have abnormal cytogenetics, or what's called an abnormal karyotype. What the abnormal karyotype sometimes points to is the presence of a gene fusion mutation. And one of the best known gene fusion mutations occurs in a disease called acute promyelocytic leukemia, which used to be the most feared subset of AML because it was the most aggressive subtype. And patients with acute promyelocytic leukemia, or what I'm going to call APL, all had a particular gene fusion and a particular chromosomal abnormality, but we didn't know what it did. And once it became understood what it was actually doing, one could design drugs that would target it. And the drugs that target this mutation have actually been spectacularly effective at treating this disease. The discovery of these drugs was largely by serendipity, but the use of these drugs in the clinic has been really miraculous, and it has transformed APL from the most feared and still most aggressive subtype of AML to now the most highly curable subset of the disease. The vast majority of patients with APL receive therapy that is curative. And the biggest challenge in APL has been, can we reduce the side effect burden, the symptom burden of that disease by using treatments that target the particular mutation itself, that gene fusion? The most effective treatments for that disease were shown to be a variant of actually vitamin A, of all things, called all-trans-retinoic acid. And it's been known for some time that giving patients with APL all-trans-retinoic acid, or the shortened form of that we just called ATRA, all-trans-retinoic acid, ATRA can be extremely effective at causing the leukemic cells to mature and gain function and actually to die off ultimately. ATRA therapy also makes leukemic cells in APL more sensitive to the effects of other chemotherapy, and that has improved the cure rate. And of all the chemotherapeutics we've found, the most effective one has been a drug that is actually a very old treatment for leukemia that had been used for hundreds of years and is actually a variant of arsenic. Trioxides of arsenic, or arsenic trioxide, or ATO, can be extremely effective as a single agent and most effective when combined with ATRA. And the combination of those two drugs together winds up being a relatively low toxicity approach to treat and cure APL. In fact, the vast majority of patients who are treated for APL with those two drugs need no additional chemotherapy or very minimal amounts of chemotherapy, and rarely, if ever, need to have stem cell transplants like Dr. Pagel talked about. So that's been a major advance in the field, was recognizing that the genes could predict what happens in terms of the therapy. And again, these gene changes happen in leukemia cells. They're not inherited. We've learned a lot more about genes predicting responses to therapy by sequencing genes that can become mutated in AML. And that's been important in terms of developing what are called targeted therapies, ATRA being one example of this. So other mutations can occur in AML that are caused by these mutations, and the mutations can cause a gene's function to change, ultimately the protein the gene makes to change, and that can activate the protein or turn off the protein in ways that disturb the normal health of the cell. There are a few examples of gene mutations that have led to targeted therapies that I could talk about, of which one of the more recently developed is a gene called IDH. Mutations in IDH were only recently discovered, probably in the last 10 years or so, and even just in that time, we've developed drugs that target these IDH mutations. IDH mutations occur in about 20% of patients with AML, and there's two different kinds. There's the IDH1 mutation, which is one gene, and IDH2 mutation, which is another gene, but the effect of an IDH mutation is the same, that a cell that has this mutation makes an abnormal metabolite, and that metabolite basically disrupts the proper function of the cell to lead to its normal differentiation and specialization into a white blood cell. When an IDH1 or IDH2 mutation is present and active, making that metabolite, that's when the dysfunction occurs. So the drugs work by turning off the enzymatic function of the IDH1 or 2 mutated cell and decreasing the levels of that abnormal metabolite that's called 2-HG. One example of these drugs is a drug called enasidenib, which targets IDH2, or ivosidenib, which targets IDH1. But there are other drugs that have come down the pike that are still in development also. There's many drugs that have been developed to this purpose, but those are the ones that are the farthest along. And each of these drugs have shown significant activity in patients that have either newly diagnosed patients who had difficulty tolerating initial therapy or patients who've had prior therapy and had a relapse of their disease. And for this reason, it seems very likely that these drugs will be reviewed by the FDA soon. In fact, enasidenib is on track to be reviewed by the FDA this summer, and we don't know, but it's possible that that drug could be approved relatively soon if the data look favorable. There are currently phase 3 trials of that drug in process. There is another target that's been very exciting, and I've been involved in developing drugs to target, which is a gene called FLT3, or FLT3. And FLT3 is a gene that is mutated in about a third of patients with AML. So again, potentially about half of patients with AML will have either an IDH or a FLT3 mutation, meaning half of patients might be eligible for a targeted therapy in this disease. And FLT3 mutations contribute to the aggressiveness of AML. They lead to the kind of AML that Dr. Pagel alluded to that grows very rapidly and causes a very high white blood cell count and sometimes needs extremely aggressive emergent therapies, including apheresis or emergent institution of chemotherapy, because patients can go from well to sick so quickly when the disease is active. What causes that aggressiveness is a hyperactivity of a growth response in the leukemic cells that's caused by these FLT3 mutations. FLT3 is a gene that makes a protein that in a bone marrow cell normally controls how often it divides and regulates how many blood cells the bone marrow makes. What the mutations do is they turn on that response in the absence of a stimulus. So the cell that has the FLT3 mutation, and again, these mutations only occur in the leukemic cell, will cause abnormal growth of the cell and very rapid expansion of the leukemia cells, outpacing the growth of the normal bone marrow and really leading to a very rapid disease progression. There have been a number of drugs designed that turn off that function of FLT3 and have led to regressions and even remissions in a substantial number of patients with FLT3 mutated AML. And recently we published data with a drug called gilteritinib that as a single agent could induce remissions in the majority of patients with AML who had FLT3 mutations and had been treated with previous chemotherapy. So that's a very exciting development. And gilteritinib is one of many drugs in this field that achieved that goal. Another is called quizartinib, and a third is called crenolinib. And all of those drugs are in phase 3 studies to see whether they can be joining the armamentarium of active leukemia drugs that hopefully someday we can prescribe for patients. A very exciting drug that has been shown to be effective in patients with FLT3 mutations was recently approved by the FDA to treat AML, and that drug is called mitostaurin. Mitostaurin is a drug that does inhibit FLT3 among a number of other enzymes, and in a study that specifically looked at patients with FLT3 mutations, adding mitostaurin to frontline intensive chemotherapy improved the survival and indeed led to more cures in these patients than compared the comparator group, which were treated with just standard chemotherapy but no mitostaurin. And the toxicity profile was not an appreciable change from just receiving the chemotherapy alone. For this reason, the FDA, about a month or two ago, approved mitostaurin to add to all of the drugs we can use to target AML. So now, for some patients with AML, it's important to find out if they have a FLT3 mutation because we can add a drug and improve the likelihood of cure in those patients. And that's really exciting to see. What we hope for patients with AML is that we hope that we can actually improve the outcomes from the majority of patients who are in an older age group. And a very exciting drug in this vein is called Vyxeos, or the chemical name CPX351. And similar to the study I just mentioned, this drug was tested in a head-to-head comparison with standard frontline therapy for newly diagnosed patients with AML. What's different about the new drug, Vyxeos, is that it uses chemotherapy, but it's encapsulated in what's called a liposome, which is a coating on it. And by encapsulating the drug, it more selectively delivers it to the leukemia cells as compared to the normal cells in the bone marrow or elsewhere in the body. And it's hoped that that may decrease its side effect profile. What was shown by the combination, by the comparison study that compared CPX351 or Vyxeos to standard frontline daunorubicin and cytarabine chemotherapy was that the survival of patients who received the new drug was actually superior. And so that drug is being reviewed by the FDA as well. And so that's potentially a second drug that could be approved, or maybe a third drug if enasidenib is approved. So it looks like there may be several new drugs that will be reviewed by the FDA, already one new approval this year, and potentially multiple approvals. Lastly, I want to comment on a drug that was approved previously but then withdrawn from the market, which is called gemtuzumab ozogamicin, or the trade name Mylotarg, which is a drug that delivers chemotherapy more selectively to leukemia cells, and by doing so, it decreases the side effect profile of the chemotherapy when used as a single agent. This drug is a combination of an antibody and a chemotherapeutic that are fused together. What happens is that antibody sticks to the surface of leukemia cells, and the leukemia cells pull it inside the cell. Once inside the cell, the antibody dissolves, and that releases the chemotherapy inside the cell, delivering it selectively to the leukemic cells, and by doing that, it decreases the likelihood of toxicity. The reason the drug was removed from the market was that there are side effects of the drug, and in particular, it did cause liver problems when it was initially used. Subsequent analysis of those studies, however, looks that it's very dependent on the dose of the drug and how frequently it's given and with which other agents it's given. There are combinations of the gemtuzumab ozogamicin that actually look to improve survival. So while there may be different side effects of using this drug, it really may matter on what the context is. And I would point out that there are other drugs that are of similar design to the gemtuzumab ozogamicin, or Mylotarg, which is easier to say. And these include drugs like SL401, which is a different antibody targeting a different protein, a drug called SGN33A, or vadostuximab taurine, and a drug called lintuzumab, And all of these can be engineered to deliver different either chemotherapy agents or even radiation or other toxic substances selectively to the leukemic cells, hopefully to decrease side effects. And the other drugs are all in development. None of these are FDA approved yet, but we are very excited about the development of drugs with this design. There are many drugs I could talk about, some of which have been developed as single agents. Some have been very exciting in combinations. One of the groups of drugs I'm very excited about are drugs that work on methylation of the genome and work to decrease methylation of the genome that's seen in leukemia. What happens when the DNA is methylated is the DNA genes can't be read properly, and thus they can't make proteins. And that changes the functions in the cells. There are drugs that can remove or change these methylation patterns, and some of them are FDA approved to treat MDS and are often used in treating AML. And Dr. Pagel mentioned some of these. They include a drug called azacitidine or Vidaza, and a drug called decitabine or Dacogen. There are newer formulations of these drugs and drugs with different properties so that they last longer in the body, and those are under clinical trials now. One of the drugs is called guadacitabine or SGI-110, and another one is an oral formulation of azacitidine called CC-486. We hope to hear more information about these drugs, which are in phase 3 trials now, and they're very exciting because, again, they may improve the effectiveness of this approach or maybe decrease the side effects, or as oral agents allow us to treat patients at home more than in the clinic or even in the hospital. And using these drugs alone may not be the best way to use them. It may be best to combine them if, again, they are relatively low toxicity with newer drugs that target different areas. This is an area that is really burgeoning in AML. If we take a targeted drug and add it to low-intensity standard therapy, such as combining these drugs that work on methylation, what I call hypomethylating agents, such as azacitidine or decitabine, and adding in a new targeted drug. One of the more exciting combinations is the combination of a drug that's FDA approved to treat a different kind of leukemia, meaning CLL in this case, a chronic leukemia, and that drug is called venetoclax. And data combining venetoclax with hypomethylating agents look to dramatically increase the response rates over what we would expect from either drug alone. And that seems a very promising approach that's currently being tested in phase 3 studies. So we're really excited about many of the developments here, and I'm going to stop talking about treatments and speak briefly about symptom control and symptom management in AML next, in probably the next 3 or 4 minutes. What Dr. Pagel mentioned, and I would emphasize, is that the primary symptoms of leukemia don't always relate to the presence of leukemic cells, but the absence of normal blood cells. And so this is what we often target when we're treating patients with AML, is the fact that if you have too many leukemia cells growing, it often means that the reason you have symptoms is because you don't have enough normal blood cells. So not enough normal neutrophils, not enough red blood cells, not enough platelets. And the symptoms relate to the absence of cells more than to the presence of the leukemia cells. This means that if you don't have enough neutrophils, you can get infections. If you don't have enough red blood cells, you can have fatigue. And if you don't have enough platelets, you're very prone to bleeding. So much of what we do for symptom management focuses around minimizing symptom burden from these areas. And some of this has to do with more prevention than treatment. So, for example, if we want to prevent fatigue, we need to give enough transfusions to make sure patients' hemoglobin is in a range that they are able to conduct the majority of their usual activities without too much fatigue. And so it's important to talk to your providers about, have you had enough transfusion support to really make any symptoms of fatigue go away? And recognize that chemotherapy commonly causes fatigue. So doing light exercise, not to the point of exhaustion, is generally a good idea during therapy, just to get a sense of are you keeping up with your usual needs and to maintain some sense of physical activity, which can really help in terms of combating fatigue. Avoiding certain medications that can be sedating is always a challenge, but sometimes necessary. Many times we'll give agents that will prevent reactions to blood transfusions that can be sedating, such as antihistamines. So if possible, sometimes I like to offer my patients non-sedating antihistamines, and that can be really helpful in terms of decreasing fatigue they may have. In terms of reducing infections, it's always a good idea to keep a good healthy diet, But to focus in on something that can be really important, good oral hygiene is really critical because chemotherapy can dry the mouth and cause mouth ulcerations that can be quite painful. And so good oral care is really important at decreasing the likelihood of mouth sores that can increase the likelihood of bloodstream infections. This could be something as simple as just salt water rinsing, which is a very simple thing that can be highly effective at preventing mouth sores, taking antivirals to decrease the likelihood of cold sores, making sure the food that you eat is properly cooked so you avoid the likelihood of getting food poisoning. Something as simple as just avoiding undercooked eggs, poultry, or ground beef is really important in avoiding things like salmonella or E. coli infections, and staying away from places where you might be exposed to food poisoning, such as foods that sit out in warmers at buffets, or even deli counter meats where you might be exposed to a lot of hands touching knives that aren't always washed in between. Avoiding bleeding risk, that seems pretty obvious in terms of avoiding trauma, no contact sports. But also avoiding aspirin or non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs that can impair platelet function. We tell our patients not to use hand razors, but to use electric razors. And again, for oral care, soft toothbrushes and no flossing if your platelets are really low or your neutrophils are really low to both decrease the likelihood of bloodstream infections from kicking up bacteria and also causing minor gum bleeding. In terms of other side effects of therapy, patients worry a lot about nausea, though I must say we've gotten really good at preventing nausea, and the biggest way to stay away from nausea is to stay ahead of the game. Take medicines as preventive agents rather than as treatments. It's always better to prevent nausea than to have to treat it, and so often I will schedule nausea medicines around triggers, whether it's the time of day that you tend to get nausea, certain activities, even just the chemo nurse walking in the room. If you know there's a certain timing of the nausea, getting your nausea meds before you need really get those triggers can be quite effective. I say to patients, one of the hardest things about getting a diagnosis of AML is keeping a semblance of yourself. So for in terms of quality of life, it's really important to really gauge what are the things that you really want to be doing during therapy, and even just write these things down. There are certainly things that you can do during therapy, which obviously is easier to do when you're out of the hospital than when you're in the hospital. But I have many things that my patients have been able to do either between treatment courses that were in the hospital or if they're on low-intensity outpatient therapies that just maintain some sense of sanity. I've had patients spend the summer fishing. They've gone out for bowling events. I've had patients who said their biggest joy was to play with their grandkids. And whatever they really want to do, I have them make a list and say, you know, let's make this your bucket list and make sure you're doing the things on your list to, you know, keep your sanity while you're going through the therapy. There's no question that AML therapy is really, really hard, but it's not insurmountable, and there's a lot of people who can really help. I'm going to stop at that point, and I think we'll probably move on to the next speaker, and maybe I can answer questions at the end of the talk.
Oh, thank you very much, Dr. Pearl. That was outstanding, a really wonderful presentation with a lot of information about various treatments and new treatments available as well and clinical trials. So I know that the questions for you during the Q&A, so thank you. And our next speaker is Ms. Caroline Edlin. Ms. Edlin is an oncology social worker, and she's our online support group program director at Cancer Care. And Ms. Edlin is going to discuss with you Cancer Care's free psychosocial programs and services and the role of support groups. It's really my pleasure now to turn the program over to my esteemed colleague, Ms. Edlin.
Thank you, Carolyn. It's a pleasure to be part of this call today. And I'd like to start by speaking about the importance of creating a support network when you're diagnosed with cancer and how Cancer Care can be a part of that network. There are many ways we can help. Cancer Care is a national nonprofit organization that provides free professional supportive services to anyone affected by cancer. Cancer Care programs include individual counseling, support groups, education about resources and how to navigate the healthcare system, practical help, and some limited financial assistance. All of our services are delivered by master's level oncology social workers and are completely free of charge. Oncology social workers are trained in how a diagnosis of cancer affects a person and his or her family and friends, and are experienced in helping people to manage the emotional, physical, and financial challenges that arise after a diagnosis. Adjusting to and dealing with a diagnosis is an important part of the healing process. Asking for help by joining a support group or by contacting a social worker for counseling is a sign of strength. Cancer Care offers face-to-face groups in our local offices in the New York City area, as well as telephone and online support groups. These groups offer a unique opportunity to connect with other people impacted by cancer, along with the help of a cancer care social worker to facilitate the group. Sharing information and understanding with others in similar situations can be a powerful experience. Group members offer encouragement and a sense of community that can provide you with additional support and guidance. These connections help lessen the isolation that many people affected by cancer experience. As we've learned from today's program, there's a lot of information to digest and make sense of. Our social workers can help you understand what this all means for you and your loved ones. A cancer care social worker can help you prioritize and consider the questions you might want to ask to get the answers and information you need. Please remember that you are not alone. Cancer care services are there to help. So please do consider contacting us at 1-800-813-HOPE or 4673, or log on to our website at www.cancercare.org for more information about our oncology social work support. Thank you for your attention and the opportunity to speak today.
Oh, thank you so much, Ms. Evelyn. That was excellent and a wonderful resource. We truly encourage you to contact Cancer Care for any help and support that we can provide. And now we have time for questions. We have a lot of time for questions. I'm going to ask Candace to bring all of our speakers on board, and Candace will explain to you how to queue up for questions. We're going to try to take as many of your questions as possible, and if we don't get your question, I will at the very end or concluding give you information about how to get your questions answered. So we don't want anyone to leave the call feeling that there are no answers to their questions. So, but let's see how many we can take right now. So, Candace.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star and then one on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question. Once again, to ask a phone question, you may press star 1.
Thank you. We have a question in front of our online support groups. We have a question in front of our online participants, I'm sorry. And that question is for Dr. Pearl. What type of follow-up will I need after treatment? Dr. Pearl, if you could address this in a general way.
Sure. It largely varies depending on what portion of your therapy that you're going to be in. As Dr. Pagel mentioned, for patients who receive intensive therapy in the hospital, the goal of that therapy is to achieve remission. And in remission, your blood count should normalize such that you don't need transfusions anymore, such that your risk of infections goes way down. And patients who are in remission can be followed as outpatients generally and may initially be seen about weekly in the clinic while getting their labs checked weekly or sometimes twice weekly, depending on how the blood counts are doing in outpatient setting. But it's not uncommon that we do recommend that patients get ongoing therapy thereafter, what's called consolidation therapy, which could be delivered either in the hospital again or with brief hospitalization and outpatient follow-up, or sometimes entirely outpatient, depending on the patient and the intensity of therapy. So it's hard to give a one-size-fits-all answer for this. There are patients whose follow-up is largely related to after completion of all therapy, and they may only come see the doctor on, say, a monthly basis or every few months if they're farther along. When we look at the risks of AML in terms of what's the risk of the disease coming back, that risk is greatest really in the first year after completing therapy. So if you can get a year out from initial therapy, that's great. And those patients need to be seen a lot less frequently. In general, I see patients very closely if they've just gone home from the hospital from induction therapy, typically weekly, until I know what the plan is in terms of their consolidation therapy. And then if they've completed their consolidation, I will see them monthly for a year. And then every 2 to 3 months thereafter until we've been about 2 or 3 years after completing all therapy, at which point I can see them kind of on an every 6 to 12 month basis. There are patients who need outpatient-based therapy who may need actually fairly frequent trips to the doctor for follow-up just because they still need transfusion support if they're getting ongoing therapy. So for patients who receive the low-intensity therapies I mentioned, such as azacitidine or decitabine therapy, While it's low intensity in terms of the side effects, that doesn't mean it's low intensity in terms of how frequently you need to go to the doctor. So I often will have those patients in the office getting transfusions at least once a week and sometimes more than once a week during therapy until we see whether that treatment is going to put them into remission. And once in remission, their need to follow up is much less frequent. The treatments of decitabine or azacitidine are given daily for 5 to 7 days out of the month. So it's actually a fair number of days that they need to be in the physician's office. But once responding, it's much less frequent than that in terms of the number of doctor's visits. I hope that answered the question.
Excellent. And there's another question for you, Dr. Pearl, which is a question that comes up on many of our calls. And I wonder if you could address this for this particular, for AML, people living with AML. Are there any extra measures I can take during cold and flu season?
Yeah, stay away from people who have colds is the first thing I would recommend. Really, the best treatment is prevention. Cold season is always nightmarish for physicians looking after patients with leukemia because we really want to keep our patients as protected as possible. But at the same time, we really don't want people, you know, socially isolated. And it can be so hard to protect yourself from all of the world's ills in terms of avoiding sources of infection. There's just no way to do it. So importantly, don't beat yourself up if you do catch a cold, if you do get an infection, it happens. But if you can't avoid visits from people who have active colds or recently had active colds or who just had another family member who had a cold, that's the best thing to do. I think in general, good nutrition helps, good hand washing helps, hand washing of anyone that comes to visit you, just so you don't spread things around. That's probably the most important thing you can do. I generally don't tell my patients who are outpatients that you have to wear a mask everywhere you go. I don't think that's really all that productive, and I don't think it lowers the likelihood of infections greatly. But I do think that if, you know, patients know they're going to be in closed quarters and can't avoid it, for example, if they live in the city and they have to be riding on the subway or something like that, it's not outrageous to wear a mask if they're in very close quarters. I generally do recommend not going into crowded areas if they can avoid it, but that doesn't mean that they should totally lock themselves off to social contact. Just use your head about this.
And to the usual, the other part of this question has to do with getting like a flu shot or those kinds of other things appropriate or not?
They're most effective for family members because they will decrease the likelihood of severe outbreaks of flu or getting the flu altogether in some cases. The likelihood of getting a good anti-flu antibody response from a vaccination goes down if you're either receiving chemotherapy or just having leukemia in general. But it's not a contraindication to getting it. It as long as it's not the live vaccine. We don't recommend the flu mist, although that's not commonly given anymore. We always want the injectable vaccine because that's safer. But I do recommend vaccination both for patients and family members. I don't really know how much it helps the patient themselves, but it certainly can help the family member make it less likely that they will pick up the flu to pass on to a person undergoing therapy.
Excellent. Thank you. Thank you very much. And then the other question has to do with I live in a rural area, and how can I access a clinical trial?
Most clinical trials will come from academic centers, and in general will require a fair amount of follow-up. So the decision to go on a clinical trial really is a personal one. The best way to find out about clinical trials is to get a second opinion at an academic center if there's one close to you. And if the question is, should you go somewhere for a clinical trial, there's a lot of resources on the web, or you can contact that cancer center if it's, you know, reasonably close for you to get evaluated there. There are clinical trials that may not require very close follow-up, or once in response, you may not need to be followed all that closely, but it depends on the particular trial and the particular goals of that trial. And indeed, even some trials may allow for standard of care in comparison to a new agent, and if you get the standard of care arm, may be able to be delivered closer to home, but even by your physician, as long as you're going in for research visits. So it really depends on the study itself. The best way to find out is to just ask. So if there's a large cancer center near you, see if you can get an opinion there regarding the opportunity to go on trials. And to find out what trials are out there, the website www.clinicaltrials.gov has a listing of every clinical trial that's registered in the U.S. One of the requirements for all drug trials now is to register at that website. So that really will show you everything that's out there. And you can search on that website by location to look for a certain distance from your home, and that will streamline your search.
And another question to you, Dr. Pearl, from, again, one of our online participants. So I'm about to start chemotherapy. How should I prepare? So if you can just give some general guidelines of just preparing for
chemotherapy. Great question. Couple things. Without knowing the type of chemotherapy, it's a little hard to know what exactly to say, because we give chemotherapy in the outpatient setting, we give chemotherapy in the inpatient setting. Inpatient chemotherapy for AML is a long hospital stay for many patients. Patients may need to spend an entire month in the hospital or longer than a month in the hospital to fully recuperate from the effects of treatment that could be delivered over just a matter of a few days or maybe a week. So it's a long time in the hospital. But when I first meet with patients, when they get a diagnosis of leukemia, whether it's in the office or in the hospital, what I tell them is there's a lot of possible side effects and a lot of things that could happen. But you have to recognize that not everybody gets all of these side effects. So while I tell them that, you know, there's a risk of nausea, you're going to lose your hair, you're going to drop your blood counts and need transfusions, you're likely to get fatigue, you're likely to get fevers and maybe we'll get infections. You can feel very sick at times. Not everybody gets all of these symptoms, and not every day is going to feel awful. There are highs and lows, goods and bads, and for every good day, you got to give yourself a pat on the back. Good, I made it through another day and one day closer to my goal. It's a long time in the hospital, and I think the most common side effect of being in the hospital getting this chemotherapy is both a lot of boredom, which I actually think is potentially a good thing, because it actually just shows you that everything that could go wrong isn't going wrong, and things are going well. And there's a lot of behind-the-scenes action that happens for inpatient care, that those things all need to go right for you to have an otherwise uneventful day. So that's a good day. But what that can lead to is a bit of anxiety. And so you need to recognize that that's a very common side effect also, of getting treatment and just knowing, you know, I could get sick from this or this could be dangerous, but nothing's happening to me. When am I going to start feeling sick? The best treatment for that, I think, is just getting up and doing things, trying as much as possible when you're in the hospital to do as much of what you did out of the hospital but there, trying as much as possible to ignore the fact that you're in the hospital and getting therapy that can be hard and that can have unpredictability and can make you feel sick, and be out of bed more than you're in bed. If you can dress in your own clothes rather than hospital gowns, that certainly gives you a personal flair. If you can be active with your treatment, get to know all the people taking care of you, get to know your nursing staff, your physician staff, your NP or PA staff, and you know, let them know your symptoms so that they can help you. You work with a very specialized team, and they can really go to bat for you when you need it. This may be new to you, but it's not new to them, and they will know all kinds of tricks to help you through it. And that's true in the outpatient setting, too, so I'll switch gears to that. You know, there are patients who don't spend a month in the hospital getting treated, but they may have very long ongoing treatment in the outpatient setting and a lot of visits, and bond with your caregivers there, with the team that's looking after you, the supportive people. Do these, whether it's focus groups or support groups, try to get involved in your therapy and learn tips from other people who might already be along the way and receiving this therapy. They can give you a lot of good advice. And again, as much as you can be an active participant in your care, try to do that and try to keep the things that, you know, make you feel whole, whether it's your hobbies, whether it's things that you save for a rainy day. Sometimes you have to take a step back from your everyday in terms of work and fill in that time space with the things that you enjoy doing, whether it's hobbies or occasional things or reading great books or reading light books or seeing light movies. It doesn't have to be heavy. Just find the things that really, you know, make you feel whole and use those as support. And don't forget the people in your life who can help you through this too. It takes a village to treat the leukemia. For your spouses or your partners or your kids or your parents, that they can be involved in helping get you through this and doing your best.
Oh, certainly. Thank you. Thank you very much. That's a wonderful response to that question. And we have one last late-breaking question from Ms. Edlund. How can I find an AML support group near me? So, Ms. Edlund, if you could comment on that.
That's an excellent question. And I would say when you're looking for a very specific support group, it's best to look online. Unfortunately, Cancer Care does not have an AML-specific support group, although we do have a blood cancers group in general where you might connect with others diagnosed with AML. So just to add, you can register for Cancer Care's online groups on our website at www.cancercare.org. But I would also reach out to the Leukemia and Lymphoma Foundation. They have wonderful online resources, and you may be able to go on their website and find a face-to-face group in your area. And certainly, I think, you know, using the internet to search for groups is often a wonderful way to connect with them. We also refer people sometimes to Cancer Support Community, and there are other online sites as well, like smartpatients.com. So there are a lot of good options out there. And again, groups are a wonderful way to connect with the community of people who really relate to what you're dealing with, the challenges you're navigating, and where you can really share information and tips as well.
Super. Well, thank you so much. I want to thank our speakers. You've all been extraordinary, just amazing, really amazing program today with all of your, both our wonderful speakers. These are great, all great questions. I know there are more questions. I'll say something about those as well. And all of you who've been listening. So I did say that I would let you know where you can go if you have other questions that you need to have answered. So, of course, we do want you to, of course, utilize your healthcare team, which includes many different professionals in addition to your treating physician. And so just be aware that your team is there and that they're a good place to go. But many of you, I know, like to seek other places for information. Of course, we will be sending you all the resources of our collaborating organizations and all the resources that were additionally mentioned today, so you'll have those at your fingertips. And we also suggest, and you'll also get this as well, but we also always suggest that people contact for medical information the National Cancer Institute at 1-800-422-6237. They also have a website, www.cancer.gov, with information specialists, and there's a live chat feature so you can post your question. And this is really nice for people internationally and also in the U.S. who just prefer to use a web-based program. And you can post your question, and their staff will really help you to come up to get information that you can then take back to your treating healthcare team. And for those of you who would like to pursue further assistance from Cancer Care, whether it be financial or practical assistance or counseling services or support groups, both telephone and online support groups, or participate in other programs that we're offering, you know, all of those things or publications, you can just contact our 800 number at 1-800-813-4673. Or you also can visit our website at www.cancercare.org. Perhaps the most important thing as we conclude the call today is that we hope you'll take the information back that you've learned today to your treating healthcare team. And also, we hope that no one will leave this call feeling that you're alone. We do know that there are times when people do feel alone. That's a kind of a reality sometimes of coping with AML, with any type of cancer, hematologic cancer. And indeed, in those moments, even before those moments occur, you certainly can contact a support organization, be connected to them, so that you know that there's a place that you can go to for support. And also many people do find either talking to someone in those organizations, whether it be Cancer Care or any of the other organizations that we've recommended, or actually joining a support group. Many people find that to be very helpful and reassuring, and also for the practical help as well. So I want to thank all of you for your participation today. We look forward to being on other programs that we offer in the future, and I wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes today's workshop, and you may now disconnect. Everyone have a great day.